Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. On the frozen Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard, near the North Pole, sits the Global Seed Vault, a storehouse for the world's crop seeds. Carved into a mountain, this seed safe house holds 850,000 varieties of seeds from almost every country on the globe. It's built to last, to withstand any kind of calamity, and to protect the biodiversity in case of climate change, natural disaster, war, or worse. That's why it's sometimes called the Doomsday Vault. In this hour, Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder talks with the father of the Global Seed Vault, Carrie Fowler, about the vault and why we need to protect and preserve the world's food seeds. He has a new book out, Seeds on Ice, Svalbard, and the Global Seed Vault. Later in the hour, we'll hear about a ballot question regarding the retirement age for Pennsylvania judges and the politics of how the question should be worded. Philly Voice's Daniel Craig will be our guest. But first, we start with seeds.
Carrie Fowler, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking you to tell us what exactly the Svalbard Seed Vault is and its purpose.
Sure. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault is a safety backup for the other seed banks around the world, of which there are quite a few hundreds of seed banks around the world. And those seed banks are conserving agricultural diversity for use in research and plant breeding. But unfortunately, bad things can happen to these seed banks. They can get in the way of a war, or there can be a natural disaster or just a human error. And when that happens, that can lead to extinction. So what we've done is to construct, a fail-safe seed bank, which we call a seed vault, and it's near the North Pole. There are a number of reasons for that. And we're storing samples of about 850,000 different crop varieties there currently.
You write that the vault holds humanity's most precious treasure, and I think we don't usually think about seeds in that way, but they really are. I mean, they're these life-sustaining, you know, tiny little packages.
That's right. If you think about it, would you rather have all the gold in the world, or would you rather have the safely stored and conserved someplace, the biological foundation for agriculture? Because without that seed diversity, our agricultural system, our food security would begin to decline and deteriorate, and pretty soon we just wouldn't have it anymore.
And the vault has been nicknamed the Doomsday Vault by the media. But it's more than that. I mean, as you say, it's really about protecting biodiversity, not necessarily a global catastrophe.
Well, that's right. We never conceived of it as a doomsday vault when we were first proposing and building it. That was a nickname that the media put on it. And we didn't think the media would be very interested, by the way. We were doing something that we understood was scientifically necessary for the future of agriculture, but we weren't sure the media would be interested. So a lot of people now know of it as a doomsday vault, and they sometimes ask, well, what kind of grand catastrophe or apocalypse are you foreseeing? And I have to say, I'm not at all. What we are really trying to plan for is some smaller scale catastrophe that could happen to any of the national seed banks around the world, and indeed have even recently. And we want to protect that diversity so that the global community has access to it in the future. And maybe I could add one more thing, because it confuses people sometimes. These are not seeds that are destined to be distributed to farmers for planting, for reestablishing agriculture after apocalypse or anything. These are genetic resources that can be used by plant breeders and others to fashion the new varieties of crops that are needed simply to keep evolution going in agriculture, because we know that pests and diseases continue to evolve. And so do the plants. But the plants, their evolution is in our hands, and we need to help them to become more disease-resistant and drought-tolerant and heat-resistant and such. And how do we do that? We do that by using this diversity that's been accumulated over time.
So it's the genes inside the seeds that might make one plant more resistant to pests or a drought or other factors that are really the treasure that you're preserving.
That's right, and we sometimes don't notice it, but the modern varieties that are fill the shelves of the supermarkets today are, in most cases, not the varieties that existed when we were children. Those varieties have been replaced. So there's a constant turnover in the agricultural system. And that's because plant breeders and farmers, of course, want to grow newer varieties that have these qualities, such as disease resistance. They really need that. Our agricultural system depends on it. And what happens is that plant breeders, in some cases farmers, will scour through these collections and they'll find an old variety which maybe they wouldn't want to use anymore as is, but it might have one trait in that variety that's really important. And they'll crossbreed it with other varieties and create a new modern variety, including that one trait that they wanted. And that's why we have to have these large collections.
Well, let's talk a little more about crop diversity. I know this is something you've been very involved in over your career. You did a big UN assessment of the world's crop diversity a number of years ago. Why have we lost so much diversity in our food crops?
Mostly, I think the reason is simply the modernization of agriculture. Mendel's laws of heredity were rediscovered in 1900. And within a couple of decades, you had scientists using those principles to fashion new varieties of crops in a very deliberate and knowledgeable way. And what that led to eventually was the Green Revolution, where you had the spread of very modern and in certain circumstances, high-yielding varieties of crops. And what that caused was, well, it was an incentive at that point for farmers to replace their traditional varieties, which were highly diverse, with the modern varieties, which were more uniform. And when farmers replaced those old varieties, there was no conservation system in place. So typically, those older varieties simply became extinct. And in some cases, we have the names of these varieties, and they were described in old literature, so we know even some of their qualities. But they became extinct. Along the way, in the 1920s and 30s, a Russian scientist named Nikolai Vavilov, realizing that this essentially mass extinction was going on in agriculture and knowing that this diversity represented the building blocks of future varieties, he started to collect this diversity and store it, essentially becoming the founder of the first seed banks.
Well, you have a chart in your book about pear varieties, and I think it's from the 1800s. And it shows that we've lost, I think, 2,300 of 2,600 different varieties of pears. I mean, that must be over 90% of pears that I guess we'll never know what they tasted like, what they looked like.
That's right. That's right. And those were American varieties, or varieties at least grown in the United States by American farmers back in the 1800s. I should explain that you can lose a variety without necessarily losing diversity. And the reason is that you can have a genetic trait in one variety, and the variety might become extinct, but that trait could exist in another variety that's still alive and going. So it's perhaps a surrogate for the scale of diversity that we've been losing. We will never have an exact I'll never be able to answer the question of how much diversity have we lost, because we don't know how much existed in the first place. But we do know that a lot has been lost, and we also know that it's not necessary anymore that we lose it. So thus the Svalbard Global Seed Vault.
Well, I think about going to the grocery store. I mean, almost any grocery store in this country you walk into, you see the same, you know, five varieties of apples, you know, a couple of varieties of potatoes, cabbages. I mean, this is the result of that loss of diversity, I guess.
Sure. And that's unfortunate. And I think it's linked in a way to a decline in cultural diversity. Many of our old varieties of crops really co-evolved with us, and they're the result of human selection over many generations. And people selected for all kinds of things, for appearance and for taste and for cooking qualities and nutrition, and as well as agronomic characteristics. But when you lose varieties, you lose that connection with the history, and you lose the knowledge of and the use of some of the very things that we were selecting for. So there's a diminishment, if you will, of the cultural aspects of food, I think, as we lose this diversity.
I had no idea there were 29,000 different varieties of chickpeas or 15,000 varieties of peanuts.
Right.
I think most of us don't realize that.
That's true. I mean, if you talk to people on the street, there's brown rice and white rice and Uncle Ben's and maybe basmati, and that's about it. But in the seed vault, I think we now have samples of 154,000 different types or populations, varieties of rice. You might ask yourself, do we really need all of that? Couldn't we get by with less? And do we have to save all of this diversity? And I tend to have two answers to that. One is provocatively to say, well, couldn't we just get by with a representative sample of Picassos and Rembrandts? Why do we need to go to all the expense and trouble of saving all of those? The answer is pretty clear. But the other thing, it's maybe a little bit more of a scientific answer, is that we don't know what the future is going to bring. We don't have a crystal ball. We're living in an age where either the weather is very bad, depending on your point of view, or the climate is changing. And that's going to alter conditions for agriculture quite dramatically. And we've had experiences in the past. I'll give you an example. One of my heroes in this field was a man named Jack Harlan. He was a plant explorer and a plant scientist, and he was in Turkey in the late 1940s, and he came across what he described as a miserable and hopelessly useless variety of wheat. And it was susceptible to all kinds of diseases. The farmers didn't like it. It was on the way out. But he collected it, and it didn't warrant a name. It didn't deserve a name. And when he got back to the United States and put it into the National Seed Bank, it just had a number, 178383. And for years, it just languished there. And then all of a sudden, there was a new disease striking wheat in the north, and particularly northwest of the United States. And while this old variety, which was, as he put it, hopelessly useless, was susceptible to a number of diseases, they found out upon screening it, testing it, that it actually offered resistance to this new race of this disease that was striking wheat. So they bred it, and it's in the ancestry, the pedigree of all the varieties growing in the Northwest now. Terrifically valuable. So you never know what's hiding in there, and sometimes you have to sort of get to the bottom of the barrel of a collection, even a collection as large as 150,000 varieties of rice, before you find what's really, really essential to keep that crop going.
We're listening to Radio Times producer Debbie Builder's conversation with Carrie Fowler. Fowler is considered the father of the Global Seed Vault, and he's a senior advisor to the Global Crop Diversity Trust. We're going to get back to their conversation after a short break. You are listening to Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. Let's get back to our conversation on the Global Seed Vault, a storehouse of the world's crop seeds. Radio Times producer Debbie Builder spoke to Carrie Fowler, author of Seeds on Ice, Svalbard and the Global Seed Vault.
I want to talk now about the vault itself, and maybe the best place to start is its location, which is pretty remote, one of the more remote places on the globe. Can you tell me about where it's set?
Sure. It's set in Svalbard, which is an archipelago north of mainland Norway. It's as far north as you can fly on a regularly scheduled plane. So if you think that Oslo is far north, well, if you were to get on the plane in Oslo, you would have to fly about 1,300 miles north of there. It's a large area. It's about twice the size of Belgium, and more than half of it's covered by glaciers. There have never been any native populations there. It was only populated in modern times, and there's a small Norwegian village there. Great infrastructure, but very small, about 2,000 people. Starkly stunning, beautiful landscape. It's home to polar bears, more polar bears than human beings, and a lot more reindeer. Arctic fox. It's just a spectacular environment. And, of course, it's very cold.
You have this incredible picture in the book, photograph in the book, of a mom bundled up, pushing a stroller along what looks like maybe an ice-covered street or hillside. And she's got a rifle just, you know, slung over her shoulder. And I assume that's because of the polar bears.
That is. I remember during the construction process for the seed vault, two people walked by on the mountainside, and I was talking with a construction worker, and he and they didn't have guns. And he glanced over at him and said in Norwegian, "Fools," and continued talking with me, because sometimes bad things happen when people aren't prepared for polar bears. They can be anywhere, anytime in Svalbard. And when you leave the confines of the village, you'll see a sign that has a picture of a polar bear on the little road there. And it says in Norwegian, basically, anywhere, anytime. So watch out.
Now, the vault itself, it's pretty incredible. It sort of juts out of the side of a mountain. It's sort of this rectangular structure. Describe that for me, if you can.
Well, it is a little bit like 2001 Space Odyssey.
It does look like
that. It reminds me a little bit like that. It is just a wedge sticking out of the mountain, and it needed to stick out of the mountain a little bit because in the springtime, snow will come down the mountain, or there could be some rocks coming down, and you don't want the door blocked or anything. But it's a very simple facility. It was built in a very pragmatic way to be low maintenance, low cost, and that's a big part of why we think it'll be sustainable over time. And once you open up those doors, you're looking down a very long tunnel, about 425 feet. And at the end of the tunnel are three vault rooms. By that time, you've gone through a number of locked doors. And we're using one of those vault rooms to store the seed. And that's the room where at that point in the mountain, I should say, and the reason we built it so far back in, other than the fact that it provides a bit more security, is that that's really the coldest part of the mountain. So in that area of the mountain, it's about -5 Celsius. What's that, about 26 or so, 27 Fahrenheit? Mm-hmm. And so the seeds remain naturally frozen there, but we do lower it to about -3 or -4 Fahrenheit for long-term conservation. So if anything, for example, if anything were to go wrong with our refrigeration equipment there, it would take many, many months to warm up to a still frozen condition. And at that rate, the seeds would be safe for decades, so we'd have quite a long time to repair.
And it does really look like a sort of no frills. And I should say, we'll definitely have pictures on our website from your book. But, you know, it looks like somebody's really tidy garage or something. The place
Yes.
where you store the seeds are in plastic containers, you know, the kind that you might store your electrical cables or, you know, nails and hammers in a garage. I mean, it's nothing fancy.
No, it's not. It's not fancy. And I wasn't struck at the time by this, but in hindsight, I realized that the committee that I worked with and the architect that we worked with, we were actually engaged in something pretty different, pretty special in trying to design this facility, because we wanted essentially to design a facility that would last forever. And I don't know when the last time was that people got together to build something that was functional and necessary, where they had that kind of time horizon. Maybe it's all sort of, you have to go back to the pyramids or something. And we didn't realize we were doing anything like that, but we were. And so we had to design a physical facility that essentially operated by itself. We don't have any staff there. There's no full-time staff on site. We monitor everything remotely. And, you know, what would a staff person do? Just sit in a frigidly cold room and watch frozen seeds? I mean, there's really nothing to do.
I think there's no toilet, right? There's not even a toilet.
There's no toilet. There's no running water. So we tried to keep the costs low. And the organization I used to be the head of, Global Crop Diversity Trust, has been building an endowment, the income from which would go to support this facility and other seed banks around the world in perpetuity. The cost of this particular one, which is the insurance policy for the others, is only a couple hundred thousand dollars a year. So it's less than insuring those Rembrandts and Picassos around the world, even in a single museum.
Yeah, but although maybe it might not have the security that, you know, the Louvre has, but there is some security there, right? You've locked doors.
Oh yeah, sure. We have quite a bit of security there, but we don't really think we'll need it. But since we were building the facility anyway, we decided to include a lot of security. So motion detectors and cameras and locked doors and people who are, you know, ready to come prevent anyone from trying to enter if they will. But it was funny, when we built it, the governor of Svalbard, that's the highest political official up there appointed by the Norwegian government, said to me, "Carrie, you know, if any of our teenagers so much as come up there and try to spray paint some graffiti on the side of the wall, we'll know who it was instantly." And we've been operating almost 8 years now, or more than 8 years, and no graffiti yet. So it seems to be a pretty safe location.
I'm talking to Carrie Fowler about his new book, Seeds on Ice, Svalbard and the Global Seed Vault. So let's talk about the seeds in the vault. How many different varieties of seeds are in the vault?
Well, we have about 850,000 different varieties now. In September, we sent 38,000 back to a particular seed bank. That's an important story. And we have more on the way later this month, I believe.
Tell me about the process of collecting seeds, where the seeds come from. You mentioned that earlier we were talking about these gene banks that are all over the world in lots of countries. So talk a little bit about, you know, that system of collecting seeds regionally and then how they come to you.
Sure. Well, most countries in the world do have a seed bank. The United States has its main seed bank in Fort Collins, Colorado. Most countries have these seed banks. Small countries usually have very small seed banks. And then there's some international agricultural research centers dotted around the world. And they also have major collections, particularly of some of our more important crops. So our task with the seed vault was really to work with these other seed banks to get them to send us a duplicate copy of their seed collections. And that's pretty easy to do. You just multiply. You grow the seed, you multiply it, and you send fresh seed wherever, in this case up to Svalbard. 10 years ago, it was a bit of a heavy lift, but most of the seed banks are cooperating now and beginning to send their copies up there. Certainly the United States has done that. There's a wonderful organization headquartered out in Iowa. It's a nonprofit organization called Seed Savers Exchange. They've sent a duplicate copy of their collection of mostly heirloom vegetables up there. So countries all around the world are doing that. And I think if you look at the original source of where the seeds were originally collected, it's something like 232 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes some countries no longer exist. So.
Yeah, so it's most of the countries in the world.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I don't think we have anything from the Vatican, but and there are a couple of other ones. But, you know, mostly everybody's there.
One of the arguments you make for the seed vault is that these individual seed banks can be underfunded, are sometimes at risk from, you know, natural disasters, from civil wars. And that, in fact, has happened, I think, in the Philippines. There was a typhoon that partially destroyed their seed bank. Similarly, Syria, I think you tell a story of getting the seeds out just before the civil war, put those seeds, that seed bank, at risk too. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those particular seed banks and the risks that
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, there was a typhoon in the Philippines, put about 3 feet of water and mud in that seed bank. And then after they cleaned up from that, they had a fire. In Zambia, there was a funny story. It had a big sign out in front of the seed bank saying it was a seed bank. And I guess people took the bank part very literally, and they broke into it several times and looted it, looking for money, I suppose. And Afghanistan and Iraq, well, they had their problems, and which is still in the news. In Italy, the generator, the cooling system there, went on the blink, and the temperature rose from minus 20 Celsius to plus 20 Celsius, and there were a lot of arguments about who should repair the equipment, and so it stayed that way for a couple of months. So all these things can happen. And in Syria, that was probably the most serious situation, potentially serious situation that has occurred in my professional lifetime. Syria was the home of the International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas. I don't know who came up with that name, but the acronym is ICARDA. And it was a major international facility housing one of the most important collections of diversity of wheat, barley, lentils, chickpeas, and one of my favorite crops called Lathyrus or grass pea. It was a major breeder of new varieties, particularly drought and heat-resistant varieties of wheat and barley and lentils and chickpeas for the Mideast. So it was an incredibly important center. And when Arab Spring started, I got on the phone with the director, Mahmoud Sol, and in the facility, which is just outside of Aleppo, beautiful, charming, one of the longest continuously inhabited cities on Earth. I got on the phone with him and said, you know, there's some troubles here, and I think we ought to get a duplicate copy of your collection up to the seed vault as soon as possible. And he responded, yeah, you know, this Arab Spring, what they're calling Arab Spring, that's trouble, but I don't think it'll ever get to Syria because things are so locked down here and so tightly controlled. So we're not going to have that kind of problem. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, but Mahmoud, just in case. And he kind of laughed. He's an old friend of mine. And he said, yeah, Kerry, just in case. And so we began very diligently to get those seeds multiplied and up to Svalbard. And we got the last real shipment out just a couple of weeks before it just exploded in Syria. And now you just have to listen to the news to know what's happening in Aleppo. So obviously, the scientists there, the international staff, they had to flee. They reestablished their research institute in two different places, actually, Morocco and Lebanon, and they needed the seeds. And they needed the seeds for their plant breeding and research work. And so we sent 38,000 varieties back to them. And they're using them in their research, and they'll multiply them. And part of that multiplication will come back to Svalbard for insurance again. So that was a case where we could have had not just a regional catastrophe, but it really would have been a catastrophe of global impact if we had lost that collection.
And as you say, with climate change, with, you know, the warming planet, some of those crops, some of those particular genetics in those crops will be more valuable than ever.
Well, that's right. I mean, if current trends continue, the coldest years of the future will be hotter than the hottest years of the past. We're going to see hotter averages, hotter extremes, higher nighttime temperatures, longer periods of hot weather when it's really inconvenient for the plants, such as at flowering. We're already seeing new assemblages of species because diseases, pests, even weeds, microorganisms are essentially on the move with the weather, with the climate. And we can't be sure. We can't know for sure how these new assemblages, including our food crops, are going to work together in the future. So we're beginning to see, I think, dramatically new conditions for which there are no historic analogs. And we're getting close to being in uncharted territory here. So I guess the message that I would have is that our domesticated agricultural crops don't come pre-adapted to new conditions. They become adapted to new conditions because we help them become adapted through plant breeding. And again, that's why we need diversity.
What are some of the rarest varieties that you have in the seed vault? Are there some particularly unusual seeds?
Oh, there's so many. When I print out a list of what's in the seed vault just by vernacular name, that list on single space will run about 55 pages long. And one of the lines on that list of 55 pages will be wheat, and another one will be rice. So that gives you an idea of how many different kinds of crops. And every time I look at that list, I see things that I just don't have a clue of what they are. Yeah. Cheesy toes. Love lies.
Cheesy
toes. Who knows? Love lies bleeding. Zombie pea. Rattlebox.
Oh,
Mormon tea. Bastard cabbage. I mean, it just goes on and on.
And I think if these are in the grocery store, people would be buying them. They sound very interesting.
Well, yeah, cheesy toes at least. I don't know about love lies bleeding or zombie pea, but some of these things, you know, sound. Now, some of them are forage grasses, but, you know, important to animals. And I do stop sometimes and look them up and try to find out what's there. But there are just so many of those types of plants there. It's really quite extraordinary.
It's amazing.
And there are a few that that I really love. I grow about 50 or more varieties of grass pea or Lathyrus in my own garden. And that's not a crop that anybody in the United States, I think, is growing. But I think it's a fantastic plant, and we have a couple thousand varieties of that up in Svalbard.
Carrie Fowler, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Sure, thank you.
And that was producer Debbie Builder's interview with Carrie Fowler, who has a new book out, Seeds on Ice, Svalbard and the Global Seed Vault. After the break, we talk to Philly Voice's Daniel Craig about a contentious question on the Pennsylvania ballot. Radio Times continues in just a moment. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. And for the last segment of this hour, we're going to take a look at a somewhat controversial ballot question Pennsylvania's will consider on November 8th. At issue is whether the retirement age of judges should be raised from 70 to 75, but that's not quite how the question is currently worded. In fact, opponents say it's crafted in such a way as to deceive voters, and thus a legal battle has ensued. Joining us now to walk us through the twists and turns of this story is Philly Voice's Daniel Craig. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's roll back the clock to April.
Sure.
There's a question on the primary ballot in many of Pennsylvania's counties regarding the retirement age of Pennsylvania judges. Paraphrase for us, how did this question read?
Right. So originally the question read, in a much wordier way, would you like to raise the retirement age for judges from 70 to 75? Now, there were some technicalities in it, but if you read it, that's clearly what it said. Right before the primaries, Republican lawmakers, along with some Democrats, kind of pulled a legal maneuver to get those votes not to count in that primary. They got it through a Commonwealth Court judge. All those votes were cast out. Now, the referendum, by early returns, not official, failed by about 51 to 49. So people essentially voted it down to raise the retirement age of judges.
Okay. So the important note here is that in this particular form, there were two numbers mentioned.
Correct.
70 and 75.
Yes, it was clear that their age was raising.
Okay. Why did these members of the legislature say a change was necessary?
Well, there are some good reasons for the change, and there are some pretty deceiving reasons for the change. One of the reasons they wanted it pushed to November was because more people vote in a general election. That's fair. More people do tend to vote in a general election. But the other reason that the question was reworded, and this is the important part, was to leave out the current retirement age of 70. So now, in the current wording of the question that voters will see in November, it's would you like for voters to judges to have to retire at the age of 75? Now, the reasons given for changing it was because it was too wordy. Well, it might be too wordy, but those words are important because it's not clear exactly what you're voting on.
Okay, because critics are saying the rewording was intentionally designed to fool voters and increase the chance of passage.
Right, and there is a little bit of a political backstory to that. Mm-hmm. Currently, the only Republican serving on the Supreme Court is, I believe, it's Justice Saylor. He's about to turn 70 in December. Now, he actually recused himself once this got to the Supreme Court, and it was ultimately shot down to change the ballot question again. But Republicans obviously would have a reason to want to keep him as Chief Justice for another 5 years, especially considering the fact that Democrats swept the last Supreme Court election last year.
Well, and actually, indeed, Bruce Ledowitz, law professor at Duquesne, is quoted in the Inquirer as saying, "It makes no sense for Saylor to recuse himself because this will allow the court to deadlock," which is what happened the first time.
Correct. Yeah, it went 3-3. And besides, I believe that same professor made the same point of this affects all judges. I mean, why would one judge have to decide on their retirement age or what voters will decide on their retirement age and another judge wouldn't? You know, Judge Max Breyer, who actually wrote the decision keeping the ballot question in the misleading form that it is now, is turning 70 this year, too.
Yeah.
So...
And so, Daniel Craig, this affects judges across the board in Pennsylvania. We're not just talking about the state Supreme Court or Commonwealth Court. It's
correct. This is judges all across the state.
All right. Yeah. And let me take a moment just to give the telephone number out, 888-477-9499 if you live in Pennsylvania. If you are heading out to the voting booth on Election Day, what do you think? Do you think that it matters whether this wording was changed or not? Does the intent of the question change with the difference in wording? If you have a moment, if you're interested in jumping into the conversation again, it's 888-477-9499. We are talking to Philly Voices, Daniel Craig, about this. So, there were two votes by the state Supreme Court. The first is deadlocked.
Right.
And then it goes back to the state Supreme Court?
It originally went to the state Supreme Court. It never went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
I'm sorry, state Supreme Court. No, let's clarify.
Okay.
Yes.
It went from a Commonwealth judge who allowed for the new wording to go the way it was. And then it went to the state Supreme Court with that new wording that leaves out the current retirement age. They deadlocked. They said they wouldn't hear it again. Now, retired judges Castile and Zapala have filed another lawsuit. That was Monday, according to the Inquirer. So there is still a legal battle to get it changed back to the original wording. But just for listeners, I'd just like to read the current wording so that people know exactly what we're talking about. Shall the Pennsylvania Constitution be amended to require that justices of the Supreme Court, judges, and magisterial district judges be retired on the last day of the calendar year in which they attain the age of 75.
Mm.
Sounds like you're setting a term limit, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you're not setting a term limit. You're increasing a term limit.
Yeah. And for many folks who might not know that the retirement age currently is 70, maybe they're thinking, oh, it's 72, 73, 75 sounds reasonable.
Right.
Okay. So you mentioned two former Supreme Court justices, Ron Castile, who's Republican.
Right.
Stephen Zapala Sr., who is a Democrat.
Correct.
And attorney Richard Sprague, and they oppose this change in the ballot question. Why do they decide to become involved? Have they said clearly why it is?
I'm not sure exactly what their logic is or what their motivation is. You know, I know that's in the Inquirer story, but I would imagine common sense. I mean, you know, and especially to keep maybe the dignity of the position. I mean, you know, but I can't really speak to their specific motivation.
Yeah.
So
even though the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court,
correct,
says to Castile, Zapala, and Sprague that they can't kick this over to Commonwealth Court. Well, on Monday, you know, as we read in the Inquirer, they went to Commonwealth Court anyway to file suit. I guess there was some legal wiggle room here. Have you seen that printed anywhere as to how they managed to kind of get around what the state Supreme Court said they could not do?
Well, yeah. I mean, the state Supreme Court said they wouldn't kick it back to the Commonwealth Court, but they're just filing another lawsuit. So they're going to essentially, I guess, try again.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing is, besides sort of the legal battle, is that voters are informed on exactly what they're voting on. You know, another argument I heard from a Republican lawmaker was that there's going to be what's called sort of like a ballot narrative at the end of the question. So you'll have the question, would you like to make it 75? And then there's sort of like a little bit of an essay explaining.
An explainer.
Oh, by the way, it's currently 70. And that's all well and good, but that's sort of assuming that every voter is going to take the time to do that, which I don't think is a fair assumption. And, you know, the analogy I would like to use is if the question is, would you like Hillary Clinton to become president, yes or no? And then there's a little essay that says, by the way, if you vote no, you're voting for Donald Trump. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just not just completely honest.
Yeah. Got it. All right. We do have a telephone call.
Sure.
We've got a number of calls coming in, but let's get to Sarah in Ambler. Sarah, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I just have a quick comment. I was listening to the ballot question as originally written and it's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just occurred to me that it might backfire on the people who wrote the new wording, because I'm listening and think, 75, that's so old. No, don't want to have that. But 70 to 75, well, that's reasonable. I would vote for that.
Yeah. So this is development is making you more inclined to vote against the question as it's currently worded.
Yeah. I don't know how other voters would feel, but if I were to read that, I would just say no. 75 is way too old. We don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Without context, it just doesn't seem reasonable.
Mm. So context is sort of turning you the other way. I find that kind of interesting.
It seems to be backfiring.
Yeah.
Sarah, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Daniel, I don't know if you've been out and about other than, looking at this story from the courtroom angle, talking to people like Sarah. But have you heard reaction to what, this legal maneuvering?
Well, when I originally wrote the piece that I did get some reaction. And generally, the reaction is that people don't like to get duped. I mean, people don't like to think that they're voting for something and they're actually voting for something else. You know, Sarah's opinion is very interesting because that's sort of the opposite, I think, of what most social sciences or political science professors would assume, because generally polling shows, and it has increased over recent years, is that people favor term limits. It's especially true. In fact, the numbers went up last year, people favoring term limits. It kind of coincides with the rise of people like Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, people who sort of promised to upend the system as it is. So, yeah, again, it gets to the basic point. Term limits, people are generally supportive of. So if you make it seem like you're setting a term limit, people will likely be more inclined to support it. And the numbers from the unofficial referendum show that. If you're increasing the term limit and you're giving people a longer leash to stay in office, I would say that people would probably vote against it. I mean, that's why I find Sarah's opinion interesting, because that's sort of the opposite of what –
So, Daniel Craig, there's a time limit here as far as the actual question on the getting onto the ballot. It's there right now, but if those who are operating legally against it want to see it changed or removed, the clock is ticking. The election is less than 2 months away.
Right, which is why I think, as noble as I think it is that retired Justices Castile and Zapala are trying their best to get the question reworded, the election's in November. So if it gets stalled in the legal system, then it's hard to imagine this actually happening, considering that the state Supreme Court already had a rather unsatisfying decision, a split decision. I think what's more important is that if the wording doesn't change, people are informed about what they're voting about.
Yeah. Well, this question affects judges on the Commonwealth Court as well, as we referred to earlier. So are the plaintiffs liable to run into the same situation?
I think that's a fair assumption. I mean, we keep talking about the state Supreme Court, but if you're a Commonwealth Court in any county, wouldn't you want the time limit on your job to increase? I mean, isn't that in your best self-interest? I mean, it's kind of funny that the question is going through the very system in which it affects, but that's why the question was worded the way it was in the first place, to make it very clear as to what voters are deciding.
What is the process like in order to get a question put on the ballot or pulled? Is it a long and lengthy process, Daniel?
Well, it has to go through the legislator. I mean, the legislator decides whether a ballot question is on. And they're actually, compared to other states that use ballot questions more frequently, they're rather rare in Pennsylvania. And there were some other ones in the primary this year. That I'm not as familiar with, but I mean, as you can see from this process, it can be lengthy, and especially if it's controversial like this, the legislative process on its own is a lengthy process. Mm-hmm. I mean, they only meet so many times a year. So you add that to the legal process it has to go to. I would find it unlikely that this second lawsuit is gonna get what it wants done in time, if it would even get what it's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, there's no sense of when this might resolve in the Commonwealth.
I don't think there's any sort of deadline, no, that it would actually get resolved.
All right, back to the phones we go. Khadija in North Philadelphia, you are live on Radio Times.
Hi, this is Khadija. I just want to say I totally agree with term limitations in Pennsylvania. I think that it's very deceitful in wording to put up to age 75. some of these people, like state representatives, sit in Pennsylvania. They've been over 20 years, and it's a very long time. Some of them don't know how to even, they're not even internet savvy tech. I believe that this needs to be, if they don't get any chance in time, they need to have this advertised in every single paper, to notify the voters of what this exactly does this mean, because it is very, very deceitful. 70 is long enough. Pass the baton off to some younger people. Let them in. Like I said, some of these people are sitting in state representatives. They've been here in Pennsylvania for over 20 years.
Khadija,
enough.
Quick question as we head to the top of the hour here. Do you find the changing of the wording of this question, do you find it confusing at all?
Well, not to me. I have a master's degree.
Yeah. Well, not, you know, this
you
is
what I'm saying.
I don't want to hammer to him. It is deceitful. Okay. So confusing, no, but deceitful, yes, from Khadija.
It doesn't make me feel good in my stomach.
Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. We appreciate your opinion. Again, the concern among those who are opposed to the changing is that some people are going to be turned around by it or might not fully understand the question. Go ahead, Daniel.
Oh, yeah, correct. And it should be noted that there is a difference between a term limit and an age limit. You know, judges and legislators, very different specifics in the how they're in office. But it essentially falls into the same category.
All right. Yeah. Jerry in Norristown, Pennsylvania, you are on Radio Times. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. So, it's obvious the wording is patently, deliberately deceptive. Particularly since when people think Supreme Court, I mean, the first thing that might come to mind is the federal Supreme Court, and we know the judges on that court can serve almost forever.
Well, I don't think, Daniel Craig, why don't you jump in here?
And it is very clear in the question that it is the Pennsylvania Constitution. But I think what the point you might be trying to make is that people who are not familiar with the current age limit might assume that it's like the federal Supreme Court and then might assume, we're setting a term limit. Because like the federal Supreme Court, there is no age limit. People can serve out their entire
lives. Thanks for restating the point that way.
Sure. And Jerry, let me just ask you very quickly, because we are almost out of time, and I asked this of Khadija just a moment earlier. Would you have confused is probably the wrong word, but would you have taken the message differently if you'd seen the ballot question in its earlier form, 70 to 75, or in its current form, which leaves out the number 70? Would you have taken the meaning differently?
I think most people would. I'm pretty familiar with the system in Pennsylvania. I'm a little bit more actively involved in politics and government than I think most people might be. So I would have known that this was actually an extension of the age. But the other comment I want to make about this is that this is wrong for another reason, is that now the focus of attention is really on the wording of the question rather than the merit of the question. Yeah. Because there really is a kind of an ambiguity in my own mind here that is it really necessary for someone to retire at 70? We know people are living longer, perhaps enjoying better health in their later years.
Yeah, it's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
Jerry, you know what? We're out of time. Thank you so much for your insight. And Daniel Craig of Philly Voice, we appreciate you joining us here on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, we invite you to check out our Facebook page. Our listeners, simply head to whyy.org/Radio Times. You'll find our podcast there as well. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.